Great. Okay, so with all those hassles and my getting up late in the morning, let me finally start. I guess it's fair to say measuring systemic risk has arrived late, just like me today. This joint work with Lasse Petersen, Thomas Philippon, and Matt Richardson, who are all with me at NYU Stern. Let me say a few general things at the outset about the paper. There's a lot of good work on banks, banking crises, liquidity crises, as Frank mentioned. Many of these models have extremely good economic insights. Unfortunately, however, these models are very hard to take to policy directly. I'm myself guilty of writing some of these models where you learn sort of, the idea of a typical crisis paper is you have one economic idea and you're really trying to build a model that's really built around that one idea, because that's what the journals like, that's what the academic profession likes, and so on. But unfortunately, it's very hard to take those papers, walk into a central bank and tell them, listen, please take my paper seriously. This is how policy should be done starting tomorrow. So we were trying to strike a compromise in this paper where we kind of adopt some of the good insights from the papers on crises, but adopt them in an extremely reduced form manner so that we are not necessarily building such a complex model that we can analyze only sort of one effect. But at the end of the day, our goal was that by adopting these ideas in a reduced form way, we can actually come up with something that will be of some use to regulators. Okay, so that was sort of our overall idea. In particular, we were trying to come up with a cross-sectional measure of systemic risk of financial institutions, which I should be frank up front, I don't believe this should necessarily be used as of yet directly, but I think it seems interesting. It should perhaps be evaluated over time, and we think it could be one input into the regulatory toolkit. So for example, regulators did a stress test in the United States in spring of 2009. How do they decide which institutions to actually stress test? If they're doing their regular supervision every year, are there some institutions that deserve more attention than others? So we think our measure might have some use in things like this. So the traditional approach to regulation, it seems to have by and large focused on firm level risk. The goal has always, it seems it has always been to limit the risk of individual bank. Supervision has been very microprudential. It's about each individual bank. And the challenge here is, of course, that you need detailed knowledge of activities inside the firm. Firms on their own or regulators might be imposing some risk limits, concentration limits, capital ratios, etc. However, this sort of traditional approach, it ignores the fact that perhaps what we really care about is the fact that when banks fail or when the intermediation sector fails, it imposes some negative externalities on the real economy. So the most traditional banking externality would be that if banks don't have enough capital, they don't actually undertake enough lending because you might get a credit crunch, as people have shown, because they only care about returns on their equity, but most of the returns from decent loans are actually going to the creditors, and there may be some other investment as a result of that. Now, there's a sense in which limiting the risk of individual bank could be the same as limiting the risk of the system. Michael has a very nice paper on this, which provides the foundations of Basel capital requirements, and which is the case when every bank is essentially a well-diversified portfolio of everything in the economy. Because then all banks are... then all banks are exactly identical. They are one and the same. And so if you limited the risk of each individual bank, that's tantamount to actually limiting the risk of the failure of the system. But we know that in reality, the world doesn't map into that. For a variety of reasons, institutions are heterogeneous. Some are doing wholesale, some are doing retail. In United States, we've had investment banks, commercial banks, insurance companies, money market funds, and so on. In our paper, we're going to allow for this kind of heterogeneity in a sort of just in a very general way, and then try to ask the question, who is contributing more to systemic risk, and can that be quantified in some way? Now, note that this criticism of the current regulation is a little different from some of the other statistical criticisms that have come up, which are more specific to value at risk, which is that value at risk just focuses on one particular quantile of the distribution of returns on a portfolio or on the loan loss distributions of the firm. But that what we should really be focusing on is something like an expected shortfall, which really averages all the losses to the left of that quantile. Because you could have two kinds of distributions, one with a very huge loss just to the left of the value at risk point, and another one deep in the tail, and we should really not be thinking of these two distributions as the same. So we are going to work with expected loss, in the sense we are going to be thinking about averages in the tails, but our sort of primary departure is really to not in fact focus on value at risk or expected shortfall of an individual institution, but look at a variant which gets at systemic risk. And it's going to be closely related to expected shortfall, but with an important twist to it. I think to motivate how our paper is designed, I think it's useful to think about the stress tests of 2009. We are quite consciously or subconsciously influenced by this way of thinking about systemic risk. And I think it touches also in some sense with what Frank was saying about these war games. We didn't have wars in mind, but it's still some sort of stress test. So on Feb 25th, the Federal Reserve System identified 19 largest bank holding companies. They said that they're going to give them some assistance to issue capital as a backstop, but before that we also want them to try and raise capital on their own. But how much capital they need to raise is going to be determined through a stress test. So between February 25th and about end of April, the Federal Reserve System, a large number of supervisors, they basically subjected the balance sheets of these 19 largest bank holding companies to a stress test. There were two kinds of scenarios, a moderate scenario and an adverse stress scenario. These were based on what kind of house price declines you looked at. They were in fact depression style declines in house prices. They looked at an unemployment scenario, if I recall correctly, of 11%, which is maybe not too adverse given what we have. But I think the house price scenario was pretty extreme. And the idea was to subject the bank portfolios to these scenarios. Of course, there has to be a mapping from these scenarios into what losses are going to get realized on different kinds of assets. In many cases, banks were using their own models to do the evaluations. But because supervisors, for a change, were basically looking at everything horizontally, which is across financial institutions, it was possible for them to get a sense of who might actually be understating their losses and who might actually be overstating their losses, etc. But at the end of it, it emerged that yes, indeed, the system is not homogeneous. 9 out of the 19 banks had enough capital to ensure that even under the extreme scenarios, they would still have 4% Tier 1 capital relative to some notion of risk-weighted assets. And the other 10 needed to raise a total of $75 billion. So if you wish, the system, according to the stress test, would have been undercapitalized in that stress scenario, undercapitalized by $75 billion. Not all banks are undercapitalized. 9 of 19 had enough capital, and the other 10 needed to raise some capital. So we are, in our theory, we are going to be asking indirectly a very similar question. We are going to assume that it is this kind of stress scenarios that we are most concerned about, that these are the stress scenarios in which the banking sector's undercapitalization might impose a real cost on the economy, and that therefore you want to ask the question, in these kinds of adverse macro scenarios, how much is the system going to get undercapitalized by, and who is contributing how much to that undercapitalization? Okay, so even though the system is getting undercapitalized, if a particular institution, say JP Morgan Chase, is not undercapitalized, its systemic risk contribution is close to zero. Whereas if you have Bank of America, which out of this $75 billion is contributing, say, $25 or $30 billion of undercapitalization, we are going to say that its systemic risk is actually high. Now, of course, in the stress test, you are just doing one scenario. In our measure, we are going to be thinking about averaging across a number of such stress scenarios rather than just taking one very extreme macro scenario. So what I want to do is lay out an extremely simple model. As I said, it's not going to be that powerful intellectually, but it's a reduced form way of capturing some of these ideas. And then the nice thing is at the end of it, it comes out with a very specific measure of systemic risk, pretty much along the lines of the stress test outcome. Okay, let me not bore you with the related literature. So let's go to the model directly. I'm going to just give a sketch of the model rather than show you all the math and so on. So there are N banks in our model. They may be heterogeneous in the sense that they may have access to different kinds of investments. So there could be just a few assets that they are engaging in. So we are not modeling where that heterogeneity comes from. There are two dates. There's time zero when banks make their investments and choose their capitalization. Each bank has some initial capitalization, W0, I0. And we assume that they are issuing some debt which may be implicitly or explicitly insured by the government. There is some fraction that we assume is insured by the government. It doesn't matter, the parameter could be at either extremes and it won't affect any of the results other than the magnitudes. An important assumption we make, which I should point out though, is that we assume in our model that there isn't any such thing as a too big to fail or something like that. So it's not the case that the implicit guarantees are actually stronger for larger institutions. We could introduce that into the model, but we don't right now. So these institutions allocate investments among some risky assets and they choose cash. We assume that the returns on these risky assets are taken as given. So it's not a general equilibrium model in that sense. So it's subject to the Danielson critique, for example, that these returns should themselves be endogenous to the various portfolio choices that these agents are making. We don't have that in this setup. So at time one, the returns are realized. If the bank is solvent, it'll pay off the creditors and keep the profits. However, if bank is insolvent, then it has limited liability. It will default on a part of its debt. The guaranteed debt will be paid out by the government, and that's the end of the world. So clearly, just in this very simple formulation of the world, you can see that there is already one distortion, which is partly induced by limited liability and partly by the government guarantees, which is that the bank owners who are maximizing their equity are going to make choices which are different from those which may be efficient for maximizing the value of the bank as a whole. Okay? Now, however, just that friction is really a firm level friction. You know, it's really a conflict of interest between the creditors of this bank and the shareholders of this bank. So if you had to fix that in some way, you could fix it through a better debt contract, but because the government is involved and it's giving some guarantees, it may have to fix it in a bank-specific regulation that might include some restrictions, that might include an insurance premium as the FDIC charges, for example. Okay? But there's no role so far for any systemic risk effects in this setup. So how do we model the systemic risk externality here? So we assume that at date one, which is the end period, you can calculate the aggregate net worth of the financial system. This is just the worth in some sense of its of its equity. And you can ask the question, we assume that essentially when this equity capitalization of the system falls below some threshold W star, there is a negative externality on the rest of the economy. Okay, we don't assume or model what this externality is. We just assume a functional form. So let me explain what this means. This means that, let's say that we are talking about a banking system, which, let's take the stress test again, that when we did the stress test, compared to the capitalization we would like the system to have, in which case we think that it's going to function as an orderly financial system, compared to that, there is a $75 billion shortfall in the system. Okay, so this is the threshold capitalization that I want my financial system to have, but actually we end up here with a shortfall of $75 billion. And we just assume that there's a multiplier E on that which measures the externality. So I don't know what that multiplier is, we don't calibrate it, but let's say it's 2 times that, 3 times that, whatever that multiplier is. There's some multiplier, and that just increases as the undercapitalization of the system relative to this threshold capitalization increases. So now, therefore, there is an additional problem in this setup here, which is that besides the fact that bankers have limited liability and some government guarantees, there are these states of the world in which we are not talking about each individual firm necessarily getting undercapitalized, because the total capitalization of the system has to fall below a certain threshold level. But of course, they don't control the capitalization choices of everyone else in the system, and so there's a negative externality here, which is that each firm, when it takes some decisions that makes it more likely for the system to enter here, it ignores the fact that if other firms also end up being undercapitalized here, you get a much higher externality in these states of the world. So basically, this is the systemic negative externality that we talk about. I think for us, the simplest interpretation is not a contagion or something like that. It's simply the fact that if we end up with less capital in an aggregate macro state of the world, these institutions are not going to lend as much, or not, you know, there's going to be some other disruption, etc. Okay, so if you had a regulator who is basically designing things in this setup, then we show that if the regulator can actually look at the bank balance sheets and measure all these things, which is what choices are they making, who's going to end up in what state of the world with what undercapitalization, as they did in a stress test, then we show that the optimal thing here is a Pigouvian tax, which looks like follows. So essentially, this model is really cooked to look like a model of pollution, okay, which is this externality is really like a pollution that the financial system produces, but we are assuming that this pollution is produced whenever the system is undercapitalized relative to a threshold level. And so if you can measure in some way the contribution of each financial firm to this pollution, then you basically have a standard Pigouvian tax that you're going to apply to that. So as you can imagine, given the two frictions I've mentioned, the tax consists of two pieces. There's what we call as the default expected shortfall, which is that each bank has some risk of failure, and it makes some expected losses which are passed on to creditors and the government guarantees, and there is, you should tax them for basically those losses. Okay, so this part looks exactly like what ideally should be an FDIC insurance premium, which is that it's really the measure of your expected losses when you fail. The second piece is of course proportional to this externality multiplier, which is the larger the externality on the system when it gets undercapitalized, the higher is this tax. But multiplying that externality parameter is the second piece, which we call as the systemic expected shortfall, which is not the bank's expected losses when it defaults, but it's the bank's expected losses when the system as a whole is undercapitalized. Okay, so now it's not, if you think that the crisis is when a certain number of failures take place, then it's really the bank's expected losses, not just when it fails, but when a number of players are failing at the same time. But we think externalities arise not just when institutions fail, perhaps even when they get undercapitalized. So in our view of the crisis, this is basically the bank's expected losses in these systemic undercapitalization states. So essentially, the systemic expected shortfall is doing a very simple calculation. It projects under what scenarios the system as a whole is going to get undercapitalized. Then for each firm, it measures for the total externality what was the contribution of that particular firm to the externality, and it basically takes the average across those crisis states. So that's the sense in which it's slightly different than the stress test. The stress test is really about sort of one particular stress scenario. Here we are trying to say if you can model these things, you can actually look at an average in this undercapitalization tail of the economy. This systemic expected shortfall contribution to the tax, E times SES, of course that's higher when the externality is more severe. It's higher if the bank takes a larger exposure in an asset that experiences losses when other banks are in trouble. So if we think that mortgages are an extremely cyclical or systemic asset, then it would say that those players who are investing a lot in mortgages or mortgage-backed securities, all else equal, would have a higher systemic expected shortfall. If the bank is more leveraged, so its starting capitalization is low to start with, then of course its systemic expected shortfall will also be higher. And there's a component that affects all the banks together, which is that if these states where you end up with undercapitalization are very likely, then of course again the tax is higher. So we like to think of the first parameter, the severity of the externality, as being just something that is going to move up or down the level of the tax. Okay, that's, you know, clearly that's going to be a first order determinant of this. We think of this as really a time series component, which is how likely is a systemic undercapitalization. And if you believe that there is some concern of pro-cyclicality, which is that you don't want to be charging these tax in practice precisely when this likelihood goes up, you can even smooth it over the cycle in some way if you wish. But these two components, the second and the third, are really the cross-sectional components. They are about the leverage of each institution, and they are about whether you are holding assets which have a higher loading on the macro states of the economy. So the nice thing about this measure is that it actually combines both the asset and the liability side of the balance sheet. You know, a lot of IMF taxes that have been proposed recently, they seem to be leverage taxes, but they completely ignore the fact that, you know, different institutions may be holding different kinds of assets. I guess it's probably as a first order approximation, maybe leverage tax is reasonable. But clearly, in an ideal world, one would want to think about the risk of the assets as well. So essentially it says that you could be more levered, but if you were holding very idiosyncratic assets, that's not such a big deal. On the other hand, if you are holding extremely, if you are holding assets which are just going to go up and down with the economy, but you are not leveraged at all, that's not a problem either. Okay, so to just take two examples of this, let me take the second example. So exchanges, take any exchange, Intercontinental Exchange or NYMEX or whatever, their assets is basically just fees from whatever gets traded on the exchange. This moves up and down with the stock market of the economy. But we don't necessarily think of them in the same systemic risk vein as we think about large banks. And I think one of the reasons is that they are not levered. Another example, maybe even better, when maybe exchange, because it's performing this public utility of providing a platform, maybe you could argue is systemic. But take Fidelity. Fidelity is very large. It's going to move up and down with the market. But we don't think it is systemic. We are not thinking of imposing taxes on Fidelity, and that's because it has no leverage whatsoever. It's always going to be 100% capitalized relative to its assets because it's all equity based. So the real question now is, so as I said, we are not going to be talking about the level of the tax in our empirical implementation. We are also not going to be talking too much about this time series component, which is of course very interesting and important. We are mainly going to be focused on using these two, so that at a given point of time, can you tell me cross-sectionally who is actually more systemic? So now we need to operationalize this idea of who has a greater exposure to the states of the world in which other banks or the system as a whole might get in trouble. Okay? So our measure is similar to the marginal expected shortfall, but it's going to be what we call as the marginal expected shortfall, which is that we're going to look at the losses incurred by an individual institution. So let RI be the return on the stock of a particular firm I. So we are putting minus because typically in the macro states there would be a loss. So this is a loss in numerical terms. And the conditioning, however, is not as in expected shortfall, which would be that the return of that firm I itself is in its tail. The conditioning is actually on a market-wide or a system-wide variable, okay, which is that capital R is a system-wide return or a system-wide capitalization, and when that is sufficiently adverse, we are conditioning on that, on those states of the world, and figuring out how much is the loss of an individual institution in that state of the world. Now, if you had a fully closed financial system, then the aggregate return would just be a weighted average of these individual returns, and that's the sense in which this multiplied by the market cap of the institution would actually be the contribution to the system-wide undercapitalization. So this was not by design, but if you want, you can think of this as the mess that's being created by the financial system, and this is each individual firm's contribution to this mess. So you're saying if it's just a it's a zero sum. So save for the fact that there is So you're right. If it was just the case that a zero-sum transaction between two banks got shocked in isolation, this measure would say it's not a problem at all. So the one way in which people look also sometimes try to think of systemic risk is, what is the effect of assuming that Citibank is actually failing? Because if Citibank goes under, will it create a big havoc in the system? So our measure is very different from that. We are actually saying that we should be taxing Citibank, that if when Citibank fails, there are some losses to its creditors, that should really be charged through like an FDIC premium of sorts. But if Citibank is likely to fail in states of the world where the rest of the system is also undercapitalized, then we should be charging them this extra systemic risk tax. Now, I think this is an important point. So I think what I like about this measure is that this conditioning variable is actually the same for all firms. So the trouble I have with the kind of exercise I was just describing, which is to say, if Citibank fails, what kind of losses are going to arise? If JP Morgan fails, what kind of losses are going to arise? But JP Morgan's likelihood of failure may be very different from the likelihood of failure of Citigroup. So it's true, probably looking at it right now, that JP Morgan, if it fails, is probably going to be the most systemic firm in the world, because it has become a large part of almost every single market. But suppose JP Morgan's capitalization right now is so adequate that the likelihood of it failing is close to zero, then we shouldn't really be going and taxing the hell out of JP Morgan at this point of time. So it's true that, so in some sense, what the measure does is that it always conditions on states of the world which are common for all firms, and therefore the conditioning set is always likely with the same likelihood for all firms. And now we are just seeing who is going to get undercapitalized more versus less in those states of the world. So it's an interesting exercise to ask if you are in a second best world and you think JP Morgan is well capitalized, but maybe it's actually not well capitalized. And given that scenario, you still want to ask the question, if JP Morgan fails, if it's imposing more costs on everyone else, I should be taxing them more. Then, of course, it makes sense. But otherwise, there is this problem, which is that when we ask the question, if one firm fails, what happens to other people? We are talking about different outcomes of different probabilities. And therefore, we can't really just start using that as a cardinal or ordinal measure of systemic risk by itself. It's true that it measures their externality, but you have to multiply that by the likelihood of their failure, which may be high or low in some cases. But coming back to your original question, yes, in some sense, there is no flavor of a contagion risk in this setup because, you know, these assets are thought to be just like traditional banking assets. We are holding loans, etc. And there isn't this counterparty risk contagion of any type whatsoever. So I think, as I said, I agree that one level it's a limitation of this setup. On the other end, any setup where there is counterparty risk, it's so hard to actually come up with some sort of a well-defined operational measure of risk that they become very hairy. Okay, so let me explain how we operationalize this empirically and show you a few results to show that there is at least some information in this measure about systemic risk. Okay, so we do an extremely simple estimation, and Rob Engel and a co-author at NYU have a much more sophisticated implementation of our measure. So what we do is we look at the 5% worst case days of the market. So let's say you are on 1st July 2007 at the beginning of the crisis, and you look at the 12 months before, so say July 06 to end of June 07, the 250 trading days, pick the 14 or 15 worst days of the stock market or of the financial sector if you want, and ask the question on those days. So that is now the conditioning set when the market as a whole has done poorly. Ask the question on those days, which financial institutions performed the worst? Okay, so essentially you'll take the, say you have JP Morgan, you'll take JP Morgan's stock market return on those 15 worst days of the market in 2006 or 2007, you'll average that, and that is JP Morgan's marginal expected shortfall, which is how much of its capitalization it lost on average in percentage terms when the market was in its worst tail. Now, of course, one problem that clearly arises with this is that if you're producing your conditioning set, so ideally what you want is the kind of stress test that the Federal Reserve did. The stock market probably crashed by 40% or 50% it lost of its market cap. Now, if you went in 2006 or 7 and picked the 5% worst days of the market, stock market only lost about 1.5% of its market cap on those worst days. So you are really trying to go from an extremely local tail, which is in good times, and trying to extrapolate out into this deep left tail, which, you know, you witness like once in 70 years, 80 years, etc. So there are two things that are relevant here. One is to essentially take this as an empirical problem, saying let's just see whether measures based on local left tails have any power to predict what are going to be the outcomes in the global left tails. Second is to recognize that besides the role for leverage that is already there in the model because it affects your starting capitalization, is to recognize that basically when you go from a local tail to a global tail, those firms which are more levered just through the leverage effect of equity are actually going to lose their market capitalization a lot more quickly. So we're going to, in some sense, identify and also empirically find an important role for leverage. And the third thing is to think carefully about what instrument you are using to do this. So I'm going to show you results using equities as well as credit default swaps. One disadvantage of credit default swaps is that in a world of government guarantees, they may not reflect the true risks of the underlying institutions. In contrast, one advantage of credit default swap is that it's really about a tail event of the firm. It's really about the failure of that firm. So while equity returns move on a day-to-day basis, you basically have this local tail versus global tail problem. In some sense, a credit default swap is nicer because it's always the price of the risk of failure of that firm rather than its entire upside, which is captured in the equity capitalization. Okay, so essentially, right at the outset, you can see that we have some daunting problems. We have a little bit of a power law analysis in the paper to show that if things were reasonably well behaved, you can go from local tail to the global tail under some assumptions, but that this leverage correction will be very important. But the real problem is these assets of the types which I think increasingly the financial sector engages in, which is to basically sell a ton of out-of-the-money options. So, you know, in good times, you're just collecting premia. That might even be benefiting the equity prices. But the real risk of these out-of-the-money option strategies materializes only when the adverse outcome actually realizes. So think about an insurance company or these liquidity puts sold by Citigroup to the shadow banking world. Essentially, it says that the risk of these kinds of assets will be very hard to pick up through equity. But I think that credit default swaps in principle would do a better job at this because they are really about default risk of AIG. They are not about anything else. Okay, now the last caveat before I show you some results, of course, to the extent that market doesn't have some information, our measures won't be able to pick it up either. So if you think that markets are irrationally exuberant and sometimes they don't price risks correctly, etc., things may be off here. My own view of the world is that market gets the absolute level of price wrong sometimes. It's much harder for it to get things wrong in the cross section. But you know, that's really open to debate. Okay. So the first thing we did is actually to try and relate this to the stress test results themselves. So these are the outcomes of the stress test. So these were the 19 banks that were subject to the stress test. GMAC is not here because GMAC only had preferred equity trading at the time we were doing this analysis. Which of course is one other limitation of all this, which is that you can't apply this method for private institutions because they don't have anything traded out there. Okay, so this SCAP is actually the $1 billion undercapitalization of each firm that was identified in the stress test. You can see that Bank of America and Wells Fargo were the largest contributors. Citigroup is 5.5, that might seem too low. I think that's partly because the assets of Citigroup that were backed by the Federal Reserve were not a part of the stress test analysis, and so the undercapitalization there is probably lower than what you'd expected. So what we do is we scale this undercapitalization relative to the current Tier 1 capital, essentially as a way of approximating sort of the loss in this macro state of the world. Here we do it by Tier 1 common. There is of course this truncation problem over here, and this is basically the MES and the leverage of these firms. This MES is calculated as of Lehman Brothers, so pre-Lehman Brothers period, until 14th of September 2008, and the leverages are measured more contemporaneously as of the stress test. So what does this number mean? Let's look at Bank of America. Its MES is 15.05. It means that on the 5% worst days of the stock market during 2007 till Lehman 2008, on average on those 15 days when the market did the worst, Bank of America was losing 15% of its market cap. Okay, that is what this number means. In contrast, if you look at JP Morgan, it says it was losing 10.5% of its market cap on average. So you can see that actually, even without sort of doing any formal analysis, while there are some outliers, those who have a shortfall versus those who are not, you can see that there is sort of a pattern in the MES. Those who ended up with a shortfall in the stress test, their MES are in all cases in excess of 10%, whereas most of the MESs here are 10 to 11% with this one outlier, which is State Street, which I've always been puzzled by, something that the data doesn't always seem to line up with. So here's basically a simple plot of that. So this is the shortfall relative to the Tier 1 equity. This is the 5% MES, actually it's 2 years, sorry, not 1 year, so there's about 28 days between October 06 and September 08. So this I'm a little less sort of worried about because you're already sampling into decent left tail of the market as a whole. By Lehman, we had already lost a pretty decent chunk of the market cap. There is a positive relationship. It's not perfect, but it's decent. So at least in this analysis, we just do a few regression analysis here. So here we look at the shortfall. Here, so basically MES explains about 32% of it. In this case, I think because you are already sampling in the sufficiently left tail of the distribution by Lehman, the leverage by itself actually doesn't play that important a role, because I think the leverage effect is sort of already in the equity market's returns out there. Okay, and we have this truncation problem that we don't have the full shortfalls on the SCAP below, so the other firms actually have excess capitalization, and I think the transparency of the SCAP results was such that you can't actually estimate the full gains and losses from the stated disclosures because firms didn't want everything to be released. So here we just do a probate analysis, and not surprisingly, actually the result sort of prevails. Yeah, Tobit would be the more natural thing. Yeah. In the other analysis, we've done Tobit in the paper when we did the thing. Yeah. Okay, so that was sort of one demo. The second demo I'm going to show you is for the entire crisis beginning 1st July 2007. So now we are going to treat July 07 until December 2008 as the crisis period. and use only information prior to 1st of July 2007. So now, as you can see, the marginal expected shortfall measured during 06-07 is about 10 times smaller on average, because you know the market losses are just not that bad. So the median loss is now only 1.5% rather than being of the order of 10 to 15%. But of course, what we are mainly interested in is in the cross section. So here's a plot of the MES against the realized returns for the top 100 firms, which are all in excess of $5 billion of equity market cap. And here you see the problem. So one, there is a negative relationship, but it's far from perfect. And you see the issue of sampling in the local left tail very sharply here. So these are all the exchanges, as I was mentioning, ICE, NYMEX, etc. Now these are basically what the measure is saying is that their marginal expected shortfall is very high. When the market does very poorly, the market caps fall down very dramatically. But of course, their leverage is not that high. So those firms which have similar marginal expected shortfalls are Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs. They are roughly in the same category. But of course, these firms have a lot higher leverage. And so when you go from the local left tail to actually a shock, which is like 40% of the market, the leverage is going to ensure that these firms lose their market cap a lot more faster. So to see this, if you just regress, so this is basically, this was, I should have clarified, this was the realized return during the crisis from July 07 to December 08. So you're just seeing how the realized return in the crisis does as a function of the MES. Now we are going to repeat that exercise, but replace the MES by the leverage. And now you can see that you see the sort of second sorting that is important, which is that Bear Stearns, Lehman, Merrill, Morgan Stanley, these four firms show up as being significant on the right side, both by their MES as well as by their leverage. And therefore, when you really try to project into the global left tail, these are the firms that are going to get hit the worst, because they have assets which are highly loaded on the market, plus they have extremely high leverages. And interestingly here, Fannie and Freddie also show up when you do this just by leverage. If you look at some of these other firms where, so you know, the interesting thing is, do you sort of pick up these kind of firms well over here? One of the outliers that the measure completely misses out on is AIG. AIG is actually reported to be among the lowest systemic risk measure as per this measure based on pre-crisis measure. It's the, I think the only one that beats us is Berkshire Hathaway. Now, several things could be going on. One problem could be that the stock market was not reflecting AIG's risk. The second problem could be this out-of-the-money option problem that I mentioned, which is that they are really selling deep out-of-the-money options, and so the stock prices in good times are just not a great way of actually reflecting what the risks are on these things. So I'll come back to that. This is actually a broad property we found of this MES measure for insurance firms, that it actually didn't work very well for insurance firms. So I'm going to come back to that a bit later. So if you put all this through in a similar analysis, so the realized loss in the crisis is on the y-axis, and these are the various measures of risk. So expected shortfall and volatility are the firm-level measures of risk. MES, beta, you could think about it as beta and tail beta, respectively. This is leverage, and we also control for size and the type of institution that you are. But basically, when you are using pre-crisis measures of systemic risk, leverage basically seems to have the best predictive power for what happened to firms in the crisis. The marginal expected shortfall in terms of explanatory power is only 6.72%. But when we go to the best model, it still survives in terms of statistical significance. But it's really leverage that's doing most of the role, if you had to look at this thing in a pre-crisis. So So if you had to use this as a tool, what it tells me at least is that once you are in the crisis, MES actually serves well in terms of explaining the cross-section very well. If you're looking at before the crisis and just want to pick which firms you should be investigating more from a systemic risk standpoint, it says maybe leverage is actually not a bad metric. Maybe you just want to look at those firms which have more leverage, and those are more likely to end up being more distressed when a systemic risk shock hits. Okay, let me skip this. Okay, so the final thing we did was to look at the same analysis on the credit default swaps market. Now, of course, this sample is very much smaller. Out of the 100 largest firms, we have only 40 firms which have credit default swaps traded on them, about 40. So we do the same thing before the crisis, pick the 5% worst case days, whose CDSs are co-moving the most with the CDSs of the financial sector on average. And here you have a much stronger explanatory power for the realized performance. So now the performance is, worst performance is more positive because it means the CDS has widened more. And this is basically the MES based on the credit default swap measure. And now actually, you know, AIG, MBI, MBAC, Genworth, these firms are no longer in the lower MES as they were with equity markets. Credit default swap-based tail beta actually does suggest that these insurance firms are actually correlated with the failure of the financial sector and the rest of the economy. Now, this is the equity market performance in the crisis explained by the CDS tail beta, and actually, it's a pretty good fit actually. So to summarize, the CDS market tail beta did a much better job in predicting the equity market decline of firms in the crisis than did the equity market-based tail beta. And we think it's because the CDS is really the price of a tail event. It's about the price of the failure of the firm, and therefore its fluctuations on day-to-day basis reflect the overall tail beta a lot better than equity market, which has a lot of the upside built into it as well. Okay, just the last thing, if you looked at the ranking based on the CDS MES, it's actually pretty impressive. So the top three insurance firms are Genworth, MBAC, MBIA, which pretty much all failed in the crisis. So these are again rankings based on pre-crisis data. The top three depositories by their risks were Wachovia, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, sorry, WaMu, which pretty much also all went aground. In terms of broker-dealers, it's Lehman, Morgan Stanley, and Bear, which also pretty much ran aground. And so it seems to have, it's, I think we were quite encouraged by this, that at least it could be a tool to regulators to figure out who to look, who to investigate more. Okay, so I should close. So just to sum up, what we tried to do is to build a simple model for systemic risk that had some flavor of being an economic model. It had this pollution-style externality in the aggregate crisis states, but simple enough that it actually tells you what is a measure that you should look for if you're trying to think about systemic risk. The measures, the systemic expected shortfall, it measures each financial institution's contribution to a crisis. You can think about it as the tail dependence and leverage because of the reasons I mentioned. In an ideal world where you could measure this precisely, the model says that you would actually have a tax that is based on this measure. To the extent that we don't yet have full confidence in this, we are of course not advocating that this be done right away. Empirically, it seems that if you operationalize this through the marginal expected shortfall, it helps predict the exposed crisis losses, but leverage is important if you're trying to do it pre-crisis. Leverage is less important if your empirical measures are based on crisis data. Different markets might have different information. Seems to work pre-crisis, in crisis, and helps predict worst systemic firms through these ranks that I mentioned. Okay, let me see.